Today we return to the beginning of Scribble.
Welcome to Scribble, 30 minutes of conversation, comments, and reviews on reading and writing, editing, publishing, and selling books. I'm Roald Tweet.
And I'm Don Wooten. Poet Rebecca Wee was the first person we interviewed on this program. She's back today as the 200th on Scribble. Well, you've aged well. You know.
200 shows.
It's been four and a half years.
Yeah, four and a half
just
years.
Just amazing.
Yeah, you add in that we've had about 8 repeats, and we've had fun drives twice a year. So we're actually, this is the, I don't think I count the fun drives. So this is program number 229. And anyway, it's been a while.
Yeah,
it has. Been a while. What have you been up to?
What have I been doing? Probably the last, 3 times I've done anything having to do with the radio, I've been saying that I was about to finish my second book.
So, yes, I recall.
Do you remember?
4 years ago. And are you?
I have finished it, and it is with Copper Canyon, and they're still deciding, I guess, but they've had it for a little bit now, and we'll see.
Now, we interviewed a poet a couple of weeks ago, and we asked her how long it takes to write a poem, and I thought her poetry was very good. She said half an hour.
Oh my! Well, so what's going on?
So what's going on? Right.
Well, I am really slow, I have to say, and I revise forever, and probably...
So does the original script come fairly rapidly, or I mean, does it vary, or what?
Yeah, it varies. It once in a while, when a poem kind of arrives and feels, if not finished, kind of complete, that can happen quickly, but I don't have that happen very often. It's a lot more work, and usually, if I do a kind of free write where I get some nugget of something that I think this might turn into a poem, that's exciting. But then what comes after that is what takes me forever, because I write a lot of drafts and I edit a lot, and I have probably just more insecurity than is good for me.
Do you put it in the back of your mind and let it gel, or do you consciously worry and fret and stew?
Oh, no, I don't know that I worry and fret about it. I fret about it when I get asked, you know, where's your book?
What are you going to ask on this program? You fret about it.
Yeah. Or, you know, post-tenure reviews or something like that, where they're sort of saying, what have you got to show for yourself? But writing for me has just always been so private. I think I've probably said this before, if I imagined a reading or a listening audience when I was writing, I wouldn't do it, because I'd be too self-conscious. So it always starts as a really private.
Do you ever worry that you're overthinking these things?
Oh yeah, I know I do. I've all my teachers, it's not new. It's just, and I have these 2 cousins now who, they aren't just slapping things out, but they're really doing a lot of publishing, and they're doing all the social media stuff that I'm just not, I don't know about it, and I don't really want to. And I know that that's part of how you promote your work now.
Good for you.
Well,
I think the world would be better off if everybody turned off their cell phones for a month. Then didn't only approach their computer once a day just to get rid of stuff.
I know.
And we would be so much better off.
Well, we wouldn't be moving so fast. My students freak out now. I sent them outside. Let's see. This must have been fall term. And I had a writing class, and it was a nice day. And I said, I want everybody to leave your phones here in the classroom, go outside and write for half an hour, and then come back. And they looked at me like, how will we know when half an hour has gone by? How will we You know, it was, and I thought, wow, they just don't even have a sense of time anymore. You know, you're just always keyed into the, and I just said, you know, well, stay nearby and I'll come find you, but, you know, or go sit yourselves near a clock if you really can't kind of estimate half an hour. But I think about things like that a lot. What's going to happen to memory, to, you know, sort of contemplative, what?
Yeah, it's thinking. That's the problem.
Yeah.
Because every time you say something and someone picks up their phone and punches, oh, here's the answer, I think, do you ever think, you know, do you ever wonder?
To wonder.
Do you ever spend time cogitating about this? If the answer is right there, it doesn't mean anything to you.
It's an interesting, I mean, I am enough of a Luddite, I guess. My family, my parents are even on Facebook, and I don't do it. So I make a lot of more work for everybody, apparently, because they have to come find me separately. But I didn't like the phone when it was attached to the wall, and I don't like it. I'm just not interested. So I can't remember to carry it. And my daughter last night just scolded. She's 10. And she said, you know, one of her classmates' mothers had texted me about something going on this weekend. And I said, yeah, I saw that, but I haven't answered it yet. And she said, my friends say it's very rude if you don't answer texts right away. And I just said, well, you're going to...
They mean within seconds.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That, and I just said, you're going to have to tell them you've got a rude mom then, because I just, I can't carry my phone around and I can't remember. And I don't care that much, I guess, about being reachable all the time.
I catch a lot of grief because I do carry my phone, but I have it turned off. And I have it because a couple of times I've fallen and I've had to call for help. You know, it's... And I think, yeah, don't be stupid, carry it, but don't turn the blasted thing on unless you need it.
Well, that's the, I mean, that's the thing that the kids who've grown up with them now, it's kind of a, it's a dopamine kick, right? That their phone going off, that they have physical kind of need for that. And when it's not happening, it's sort of like they don't
apparently
exist.
Apparently it is addictive. And
it is.
And the companies know that. And
it
they,
is.
They play on it.
It is. Yep. And if I had kids now, I wouldn't let them near a phone. They'd probably call the child's court or something for cruelty.
That's the, well, I my son, who's 15, he's not really very interested in his phone, but he has to have it for school. They send them all their notices.
Right.
They send them, you know, it's like they can't be disconnected now. But he kind of, he's, I guess, a little bit like I am, where he just forgets about it, and then he's in trouble because he hasn't responded.
Right.
And, you know,
well,
it's...
if you don't have a phone with you, how can you read us one of your poems? I mean, it sure they have a phone.
I still have, you know, that threw me the first time that in class I asked students to read, and they pulled their phones out, and I thought, what are you doing?
Well, we've had people here do that.
Sure.
That we've interviewed.
I think it's too small. You can't even see
it,
you know?
I want to try, this past winter, read a Jane Hirschfield book on poetry called 10 Windows. And one of the statements that she made there, I've sort of asked everybody who's been on the program since then, and this is the statement, no good poem is ever entirely safe.
Oh, that's an interesting, safe from what? Safe from critics, safe to read,
dark
safe
edge.
To, yeah.
What separates it from a Hallmark card?
Oh, what separates it
no,
from
I mean, is the unsafe?
Oh, probably. I mean, I think that good art is not safe ever. You know,
right, well, that's what she's...
Well, there's that Gwendolyn Brooks line that's something like, art, let's see if I can remember it. She says, art hurts. Art urges voyages, and it is easier to stay at home, the good beer ready.
Right.
That's her statement, and it's kind of like, no, if you're going to go there, and you're really going to go there rather than sort of going through some motions, yeah, you don't know what you're in for. You don't know if you're going to burst into tears or you're going to...
Oh, I used to tell my kids when I was teaching, I said, remember, a poem is a hand grenade.
Yeah.
You pull the pin and all sorts of things. If you're reading it, if you're really reading it, all sorts of things explode.
Yeah. Yep.
And your mind can go anywhere.
And that's, I think, for students, both the surprise and the discomfort of like a writing workshop where, you know, I'll give them a prompt and they have to start writing and they don't know what's going to arrive, what their memory's going to do, where they go with that. And, you know, sometimes they're just bored and not much happens. But when something does, you're really vulnerable. And, if you're not sitting right in your study by yourself, you're surrounded by people who are, you know, maybe or maybe not watching you.
One of the tests I have for self-control is to try to read aloud Ballad of the Harp Weaver without bursting into tears end.
Yeah.
I can't do it. I can't do it.
No, it's true. And that's another interesting thing, I think, when I tell the students, pay attention when something gets under your skin, you know, even if it's because you're thinking, I don't like this, this makes me uncomfortable, because there's something there. There are plenty of poems that aren't going to move us, you know, that should, because they're good poems or people have loved them forever. But when something gets to you, you got to pay attention to it.
Well, now, even though you don't have your phone, surely you have a poem on some written
recently
form.
Completed book.
Yes, I did bring my manuscript. Here it is. And I've probably read, you know, I've had these around for a long time, trying to think of something in here that maybe...
I like that. Like maybe.
Four years ago, you were just finishing it.
Yeah.
Another month or so, and it would be done.
Yeah, and 5 years before that, I was just finishing it, too. So it's been a while. It was interesting to try to finally sort of pull it together because they're so old, so many of the poems, and it felt good to think, okay, I'm not abandoning them, but I can leave them and I can start writing some new stuff. Because
I sensed you're too sensitive. You flip through these pages and you go, no. I think, well, come on.
Yeah, I'll find something. I'll read this one, which I might have read before, but I wrote it for Donald Hall. Well, I didn't start out writing it for him. It was a prompt that I gave one of my classes. We were learning acrostics, and acrostics are the poems that spell something down the left hand side. And so it was National Poetry Month, which it is again now.
Right.
Yeah.
And
By the time we're on the air, it isn't.
It won't be anymore. Well. So it was the words that are spelled down the side is poetry is dead. And I think our class was having a discussion about how, you know, every 5 years somebody proclaims that it's dead and then everybody gets in an uproar. And so we were all writing in response to this. And this was the one I wrote without – so I did do this one really quickly. I almost didn't revise anything. And then it was one of those poems that later I figured out what it was about. It was smarter than I was. So it's just called Acrostic Response to Another Essay on Poetry's Irrelevance for Donald Hall. Piss painful as a bone bruise, the old alarm of irrelevance shrills on. The anxious ever-endingness of the once loved gone to ruin. Gray-green oblivion. It reads like this. You are finite. You will be outdone, used up, mossed over. It won't matter how brilliant or base your heart's song was, or whether you sang at all. Detritus, devoured by doubt, debt, dandelion fizz in the wind. Every one of us, a bit of vast and provisional pixelation. And it's over. Like that. Ta-da! Ashes to ashes, etc. Dust to goddamn dust.
That's very mean.
Yeah, it was a mean poem that kind of surprised me when I
love it though
it.
Because it's you know, I've had thoughts like that a lot.
Well,
and that really speaks to me.
I think Don Hall, who was one of my mentors and one of my teachers, has a long essay on death to the death of poetry, and it's an old essay from a long time ago, but he was passionate on this, and what I discovered about this when I wrote it, because I haven't, I just get annoyed that people are always saying poetry's dead, you know, but I don't have a, an axe to grind about it. But I went back and looked at this and thought, why, where did this come from? All this, what's the gray-green oblivion and what's the you will be outdone and used up and mossed over? And I realized that it was an anniversary from when my husband died, my late husband, who died, you know, almost 30 years ago now. And that the poetry is dead had to do with that anniversary of his death, and that my anger probably was this unconscious response even to just how we die, that we die and we're gone. Whatever you believe happens to us afterwards, for the people left behind, we're just gone. You know, we're not here. And so I don't know. Well, yeah, it's about poetry, but I think it's just also about loss. And the fact Don died this last summer, and I got the phone call from his assistant kind of in the middle of traveling, saying that he had just died in the night. And he's my first serious mentor who really helped me through Michael's death, because Jane Kenyon, his wife, had died also of leukemia. And so I had gone to Eagle Pond Farm that summer after Michael had died, and we had spent a lot of time at Jane's grave just crying and talking about grief. And he was elderly, and he knew it, but he was still so feisty. I think I had written to him last spring, and he wrote back and just said, you know, great to hear from you. Now write me again. And I didn't, and he died. And it's one of these things that now I'm sort of grieving about, you know, that it was just too busy. Well, I had shingles last spring, and so I was I was miserable, and I didn't do much for a couple of months, and then it was summer. And
you know, you do things like that. And I'm guilty of that too. I think, yep, I should go see him. Mm-hmm. It's been a while. And then the thought passes and other things intrude. And then you read an obituary and you think, oh my goodness.
Yeah. Well, I was so glad that at least I had written to him fairly recently, and he was pretty spunky. I think he was facing his 90th birthday, and he didn't get there because it was in the fall, and he died in the summer. But
well, I got there, and it's no picnic.
So. Yeah. Yeah, that's
How about another poem? I mean,
All right. I'll see if I find one in a different mood than that one.
I don't know. That mood's fine. That's, what do you want?
I did make one that's kind of a found poem from my kids. I don't know if it's a good poem. It maybe shouldn't be in here because I stole it.
This your book is done, Rebecca. It's done.
Pete, give it a rest.
I'm trying to think what you need to know in order to. This is mostly my daughter's voice, and I have a thing about foxes that I think will come clear in this book because there are a lot of fox poems. Foxes started to appear in my life at really important, crucial moments. And sometimes they meant something good was coming, and sometimes they did not. But it's been true now for about, when did this start? It started after my MFA. So I went and lived at my family's cabin in northern Minnesota for about 6 months in the winter. And there was a fox that left tracks around the cabin. I would find the tracks along my cross-country ski trails when I went out the next day. And then one day in the spring, it came out of the woods and came right up to me like a pet dog, and I got really scared. But after that, they appeared when I remember I was going for a job interview at Gustavus before I came here to Augustana. And I was suffering depression, and I was in the middle of a first divorce, and I was just in bad shape, and I was supposed to go to this job interview, and I stopped. I pulled off the road in a cornfield and just said, I'm not going. They won't. It doesn't matter. I can't, you know, I just can't do this. I can't go there and pretend that I'm any kind of authority. And out of the corn walked this fox right up to me, like the one at the cabin, and kind of sat down and cocked its head and looked at me. And I thought, okay, I'm getting in the car. I'll go to the interview. I'll go, you know. And I got the job. And, you know, it's so they've been really important in my life. So this one's called Single Mom, but all the rest of it is my daughter, and actually comes from a bunch of drawings she did. She was drawing me as different creatures, and that's what came into the poem. So most of this is her explaining her drawings. Single Mom. Sometimes she's a fox or thinks she sees one in the road. Sometimes she's a love mama wearing all hearts on her sleeves. Some days she's robot mama and we stay in our rooms. But when she's mad mama, we can't even laugh at the table or make our broccoli into trees or bubble our milk with straws. Some mornings she's oatmeal mama. She doesn't like to cook, but she does like my apple and carrot peel salad. Which I don't, actually, but I've told her I do. We named our club Team Mama the day we couldn't find her. I drew her once with the world's biggest mouth. Sometimes she's flabby mama with her soft arm skin. She's crinkle mama, who's the same as beautiful mama when she smiles and puts pink chalk in our hair. When she's hot dog mama, she wears a big bun. She didn't even know how funny that was. When she's duck mama, she has wings. Yellow bird mama, the same. Sometimes she's a Norwegian boohund mama, and you have to look that up because even our vet never heard of a boohund. That's her dog. Most of the time she's messy mama. She should be storm mama because she likes tornadoes and rain. Book mama, sapphire mama, best mama in the world, even though she doesn't love our daddy anymore. Oh, pain to the heart. Silly mama, blue mama with sad eyes. I have curly hair like curly hair mama, but she's the only one with blue eyes. Blue mama, tattoo mama, Halloween mama dressed like a dog. Wizard mama with lightning, mama who forgets things. Like our neighbor's names, like where she put her keys, like why she loved daddy. Like how many foxes she's seen. So that's my daughter.
That's
knowing a whole lot more than right. She knows.
That's great.
Yeah,
I like that.
So
you are worth knowing better. You know, multifaceted person.
Well, the drawings are hilarious. I mean, it's pretty tempting to. The duck mama was my favorite one. But she went through a lot of phases where she'd come in and, you know, here's a carrot mama, here's a crinkle mama.
Are you still, I mean, you have, your book is actually coming out or it's in the hands?
No, it's in the hands of the people who will decide.
They will decide.
If they decide no, then I have to send it elsewhere. But I went to Copper Canyon because they were so good to me the first time and I just decided I feel loyal to them whether they feel loyal to me or not.
Now that the book is moving, are you writing any additional poetry?
That's the plan for this summer because I will finally kind of not have this to deal with. And it happens that this summer my kids are mostly with their dad and my son is going to France for a school trip. And so I actually only have them for about 3 different weeks. So I'm hoping to go to a friend's cabin in the mountains who's his mother-in-law died and left this cabin to them. And he was a friend of mine in grad school when we were writing poetry. And he said, please, 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 please go to the cabin and write. Yeah. So I'm hoping to take him up on that. I'm not going to hold and I'm not doing
that
some of the...
reminds me of what you said the first interview 4.5 years ago when we got you in here as a poet, and Don said something about, so you're a poet. And your answer was, I'm not a poet.
Really?
Because,
shame on me.
Because at the moment, you,
oh,
because
I wasn't writing.
I wasn't writing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's how it feels. I always scold my students if they say they're not poets, you know. But
you said it.
I said it, and that is how.
And we thought, it's going to be a long half hour.
Oh, yeah, if I just talk about not being a poet. No, I think if you're a poet, you you can try to cast it aside, but it's going to follow you around. And so even when you're not writing, I do believe this. Something's happening. You know, I don't keep journals anymore, and I used to keep journals before I had kids because I had time, and that's where I kind of thought things through. And now I'm just running from, you know, one thing to the next, and I don't keep journals.
Do you have any kind of a writing schedule? I mean, do you try to get in some writing every day? Or
I used to always write at night, and at night I'm madly grading and washing dishes and, you know, doing that. So,
but you're planning this summer to write. Now, do you have enough discipline to make yourself write?
That's a good question. I think so, because it has been a long time, and you do start to feel like a fraud. I mean, when I'm teaching and I'm sort of forcing my students, saying, you got to write every day, you guys, it's like anything else. If you're going to get better at it, if you're going to grow and change, you've got to do it. And then I go running around doing my grocery shopping and laundry and, you know, think, no, you got to write.
But this is an interesting thing for a woman.
Yeah.
When you have children, your life is never the same.
Yeah.
And you have to make adjustments if you want to continue with the life that you had in mind. It's going to take great strength.
And you are exhausted a lot. And I had kids late in life, so I'm tired. You know, I think, man, if I had done this when I was 20, maybe, you know, at this point I'd be a little feistier. But, it's hard to make it work. And some people make it work better than I do. I'm jealous right now of these two cousins of mine, because neither of them are married. They don't have kids. And they can travel, and they can stay up all night, and they can do a whole lot of things that I miss being able to do, and they're way more prolific than I am.
Well, you know, it's interesting. When you age, as I have, and suddenly you have time. Suddenly you have time, and you think, okay, where's the energy? Where's the ambition?
Yeah.
Where did it go?
Yeah. No, it's true. I mean, a lot of the things I even thought that I would do as a teacher, like take overseas terms and things, I don't and can't do because I've got kids and I'm driving them to school.
You're going to go to a cabin.
You are making sure this is.
And you are going to write.
To write the next.
And you're
going to
come back and be our 300th guest.
Okay. I like that.
And, you know, you have, I mean, there's your goal right there. You certainly want to be on this program again.
Yes, exactly.
Who wouldn't?
And I cannot come on here again and say, oh, I just haven't written anything since I was here last.
You can't pull that I'm just finishing my second book again.
Right.
You've used that.
Well, and I have tried over the years when I'm on the radio or I'm in giving a public reading, I will say, oh, I have a book coming out, trying to force myself to live up to it. But I, you know, haven't done that very well until maybe now.
Well, we'll hold you to it.
Okay.
And, you know, this, your being here today is just a little exercise, you know, to remind you that.
Exactly. Yeah.
Second book comes out or not, keep writing, Rebecca.
Rebecca
Wee, poet, whether she thinks so or not, is our guest today. I'm Don Wilt with Roll Tweet. Thank you for being with us. We'll see you next week on Scribble.